Odprti termin Radio Študent.
V petek 22. avgusta smo ob robu festivala Grounded, na katerem je gostoval, govorili z britanskim aktivistom Charliem Thomasom. Thomas je na festivalu Grounded gostoval kot predstavnik organizacije Delavci za svobodno Palestino, ki si prizadeva organizirati britanske sindikate, da izvajajo pritisk na orožarsko industrijo. V preteklosti pa je bil tudi član organizacije Palestinska akcija, ki jo je britanska vlada nedavno razglasila za teroristično organizacijo in prepovedala. Kot član Palestinske akcije je Thomas sodeloval v okupaciji ene od orožarskih tovarn, zaradi česar je bil obsojen na 2 leti zapora.
Okay, I think we are fine and we can start for real. So, your guest here on Grounded Festival in the panel on unions and Palestine action, and you're part of Workers for Free Palestine. Can you maybe tell me a little bit about this organization, what you do, what's the idea behind it, the methods you use?
Workers for a Free Palestine was formed in 2023 in response to Israel's bombardment of Gaza. It was responding to a call made by the Palestinian General Federation of Trade Unions, or the PGFTU to be short, because there was an absence from the union leadership of action around Palestine. We initially formed as a motley group of trade unionists who would go and do flying pickets at different sites. So we would do a picket at an arms factory if we knew that it was involved in the production of F-35s. Of course, F-35s have been really instrumental to Israel in their complete decimation of Gaza. So we'd pick sites like this, and a whole load of trade unionists would go outside and we'd pick it for as long as we could. Obviously, this caused some contentions within the trade union movement. Some people hated us, some people liked us but didn't think we were doing things properly and going through the proper legal processes. So now we have an organization that is essentially trying to slowly develop trade unionists who are willing to go on strike and commit to industrial action in order to break ties with Zionism, because we know that our government essentially won't do it for us and that it's something we have to do ourselves, and that the best place we're able to do this is really in our workplaces.
And you mentioned that trade unions historically in Britain were Zionist for a very long time. Can you tell me a little bit more about this background?
Before the Balfour Declaration, in which the British leader, Alfred Balfour, pledged to recognize the establishment of a Jewish ethnostate on historic Palestine, we had this thing called the War Aims Memorandum. The War Aims Memorandum was a document that tried to envisage what socialism would look like in Britain once the socialists had come to power. It was written by trade union leaders and by members of the Labour Party, when the Labour Party and trade union leaders were inseparable. And essentially in this document, they write this very radical thing in some ways, which says the private arms industry has really been a prominent cause for the First World War, in which working class life was completely decimated. And so any socialist country would set about destroying the private arms industry. But in this same document, they said way before Balfour that they also wanted to see the establishment of this Jewish ethnostate, which has become Israel. This was for loads of reasons, namely because early Zionists called themselves Labour Zionists, and they were selling a vision of their future state as a socialist state. And Britain, of course, had at the time its own form of colonial socialism. So this didn't seem really like a contradiction in kind to British socialists, that you could have socialism in one nation and then everywhere else would be a colony where you were extracting huge amounts of wealth and resources. So that union support continued for quite some time, as long as there was a Labour Party in power and Britain had control over Palestine. But this started to shift in the 60s. This was because the PLO and Fatah had decided to internationalize their campaign as a means of overcoming the strangulation of the political space by the Israelis, who had, you know, just won the Six-Day War, essentially. So they started to internationalize their campaign by hosting these huge meetings, which loads of different socialists from all parts of the world would come to. And some of the British socialists that attended those meetings, those conferences, then went back to England and established the Palestine Solidarity Campaign. So The Palestine Solidarity Campaign has continued to slowly advocate for Palestinian liberation, but in quite limited ways at times. And it's tried to do this through appealing to trade union leaders and leaders of civic society organizations and politicians. And it's got real sway in the trade union movement, but what it's able to do currently is push trade unions to adopt BDS within their own offices. So, for instance, the Unite office, Unite the Union being the biggest union in the UK, they won't use any Israeli products. They won't use, for instance, Hewlett-Packard or HP printers. But at the same time, they will protect the jobs of arms workers and other workers who are really deeply implicated in Israel's ongoing violence and colonization of Palestine. So there is this sort of tension that exists within the trade union movement, which is sort of why Workers for a Free Palestine emerged, in order to sort of put pressure on that tension and to push the trade union movement to basically commit to Palestinian liberation more.
Is Workers for Free Palestine part of this wider, more moderate movement? Is that correct, or is there a tension or a conflict between the two approaches, let's say?
I think that individuals in these different organizations have issues with the ways in which different people organize. But I'd say that these organizations really complement each other. So, for instance, if you look at the Palestine Solidarity Movement, it does very, very slow advocacy work, but it's also a huge organization, which means that it's been able to really, really move people across small towns and across Britain for many, many, many more years than we have. And I think because they've done that really slow legwork, that meant that other organizations such as ourselves, such as Palestine Action, could emerge quite quickly. And the job of educating people around Palestine did not feel like a task that took up all of our space. This was a task that the Palestine Solidarity Campaign had already done. So I don't see ourselves in competition at all. I see ourselves as really potentially very complementary. We just have different focuses.
You have described the support for a Palestinian cause in Britain as a mass movement. So on one hand, you have mass movement. On the other hand, you have leadership of the country, leadership of maybe the unions, who are much more cautious, if we're kind, to their actions.
The union leadership has been really marked by the fact that a lot of them, simply put, are not anti-Zionist. They don't share the aspirations of a lot of their members. So we've seen in Unite the Union, the biggest union, a real attempt at the leadership to clamp down on the rank and file, clamp down on the membership in their constant call to essentially cease all trade with Israel, to enforce an arms embargo from below, an arms embargo by the workers, and to begin to politically isolate Israel, because this is the only way in which this country is going to fall, is if it endures the same treatment that the South African regime once did and is completely politically isolated, as well as materially and financially isolated. So there's been this ongoing battle, but there is, of course, some space for democracy in unions. And at the recent executive committee of Unite the Union, a group of the membership was essentially able to push the union massively to supporting workers who did not want to basically produce or transport things that would be used by the Israeli military. So this is really huge, because in England, it's technically illegal to engage in a political strike. But there are ways around it, ways in which workers use community organizations to engage in political strike. For instance, the dock workers will have a community organization blocking entrance to a dock, and then the dock workers saying, this is a health and safety issue, so we're not going to be able to enter, but this is all something they've all agreed to do. Essentially, what the union leadership is now giving people the right to do is engage in these creative ways of surpassing the law. There are other ways in which they've basically agreed to support Palestinian liberation more concretely, like refusing to organize with the Histadrut, which is the Israeli Trade Union Federation, a historically racist vehicle which has deliberately excluded Arabs from participating in it. So the union leadership has been challenged and it has been shifted slightly. As for the leadership of the country, I don't think we can be charitable about them at all. I think that they have shown that they have no regard for the popular will of the country, and that they are willing to completely cover themselves in blood in order to appease Trump. Really, I don't think we can rely on the leadership of the country to do anything at all. We have to create the movement ourselves that creates the sort of crisis that means that it's impossible for the leadership to keep going with this.
Can you maybe talk about this move to criminalize freedom of assembly, let's say? It started, I believe, already with the laws about public order with the last conservative government. But now Palestine Action, of which you were also a member in the past, was made basically a terrorist organization. So this is also a longer process of criminalizing protest.
I mean, I think Britain at its core has always sought to criminalize forms of assembly and resistance in numerous ways. And I think you can look through the 20th century to find many different examples of this. But in terms of looking more closely at this moment, you're right to bring up the fact that it was the Police Crimes Sentencing and Courts Bill that was introduced under the Tory government that essentially sought to shrink the already very small space people had to protest so that you can essentially do years and years in prison for in any way meddling with public infrastructure. And when I say meddling with public infrastructure, that can mean lying in a road for more than 5 seconds. That can mean climbing onto a bridge in some way, as we saw with some environmental activists. That can mean engaging in protests that are too noisy or that have not already been signed off by the police in agreement. They keep trying to sell us this idea that a protest is something you agree with the state to do before it takes place. This isn't what a protest is. The point of a protest is to disrupt the normal order of things. So this has all been part of their mission to continually find ways to contain dissent in this country.
But when you say that Britain has always tried to limit the right to protest, what do you mean by that?
You look back to Thatcher and you look at the mining strikes where police essentially engaged in a siege on working class people, fighting for their rights to a good life, to a stable wage. And that there's been this constant process through which Britain takes the technologies and techniques it's learned in its colonies and brought them back to Mother England to police its dissenting communities. I say dissenting communities in a sort of broad way because that can also just mean racialized communities or marginalized communities. For instance, when there were riots because of police violence towards black people, the police began to use CS gas. This was originally used in Ireland, and then they thought, hang on, let's bring it back to England and we'll use it on protesters. All of these things have a sort of colonial lineage because before that, the police force from Ireland were taken to govern Palestine. And so there is this sort of interconnection between England and its ex-colonies and its police force and the methods it uses. So obviously Britain is without colonies to this day, but I would say that it is still an empire in some ways, that it still engages in forms of imperialism. And there is this constant exchange going on with various security forces, including, of course, the Israeli security forces, to refine its techniques of containing public dissent.
But on the other hand, there is, I have this impression, a long history of protest in Britain that used methods of, I don't know, direct action or civil disobedience. Can you tell me a little bit about this tradition of protest and civil disobedience from which Palestine Action and Just Stop Oil and other organizations are growing, maybe?
Yeah, I'm more than happy to do that, but I'm warning you, I will get a bit nerdy. Palestine Action is a particularly interesting case because if you look at Britain, it's got this really very, very old anti-militarist form of direct action that predates the 20th century and was engaged in by sort of Quakers and Catholics of all kinds, in which they would destroy armaments as a statement against war. If you're interested, the historian E.P. Thompson writes a lot about this. The tradition that Palestine Action draws from is a slightly newer one. So there's been a host of anti-militarist organizations and campaigns throughout the 20th century. If you look at an organization called a Quaker Action Group, which I can imagine Palestine Action might take inspiration from, this was like an early form of anti-imperialist anti-militarism, where Quakers got together and they decided to try and disrupt the ongoing ties between the various Western countries and America during its war in Vietnam and attempted to overcome blockades by sending little boats to northern Vietnam to support the North Vietnamese Army and the National Liberation Front in the south too. So there's this sort of history. There is the fact that groups like the Seeds of Hope campaign were completely led off in the legal system by appealing to the jury's sense of morality. The Seeds of Hope campaign were a group of feminist anti-militarists who destroyed Hawker jets that were going to be sent to Indonesia at a time that Indonesia was occupying East Timor. They're able to get off using various legal arguments that have now been closed off. So there's like a really long and rich history of engaging in direct action and civil disobedience in this country, in particular in relation to arms and the fact that Britain essentially acts as an arms depot for some of the worst regimes across the world. People have long battled against that, using their bodies and risking quite a lot as well.
You mentioned also on the panel that this kind of appeal to morality of your action is being shut down in the courts also, so the stakes for engaging in the protests are much higher. Why this change in policy by the state towards the protest?
So I think essentially the change has come about because they know that they can't really govern by consent. And because of that, they have to govern by force and they have to terrify people and say to them, if you damage our reputation with Israel, if you damage our reputation with the arms industry, we will completely destroy you and we will make your life hell. And I think it is a testament to a lot of people in the country that these movements do continue in various ways despite this. I mean, very shortly after, a group emerged. I believe it's called Shut Leonardo Down. Leonardo is the...
We're buying helicopters from them right now.
Okay, we make some of those helicopters in the UK and immediately engaged in the sort of direct action that Palestine Action once did. And on a slightly funnier note, we also saw Palestine Action change their name to Yvette Cooper in the hope that Yvette Cooper would then prescribe Yvette Cooper in Parliament, which unfortunately didn't have its day. But yeah, that was one sort of slimmer of hope amidst an otherwise quite bleak situation.
If we move now to maybe your activity and experience and to Palestine Action in general, it was established in 2020. Can you tell me about why it was established and what were your reasons for joining?
Palestine Action was started by a group of activists who used to be part of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign. They didn't believe that the Palestine Solidarity Campaign was providing the necessary support for the liberation of Palestine. So they started this organization that was focused on disrupting the arms industry in Britain. It initially focused on Elbit Systems. Elbit Systems, for those that don't know, provides 85% of land and air-based gear and equipment for the Israeli military. It's a really crucial component of it. It had 9 sites in the UK, but Palestine Action managed to take 2 of those sites out of operation. And by take them out, I mean it consistently had people that were willing to go onto the factories, to occupy them, to destroy what was being made in those factories, and to cover their facades in red paint and hold banners. This is kind of where that movement emerged from the kind of mainstream solidarity movement, but it sought to do something slightly more direct. Sorry, can you remind me of about my own involvement in the second?
Yes, what were your reasons for joining a year later, 2021?
If I'm honest, as embarrassing as it is, one of the reasons is because I had just been involved in Corbyn's election campaign and door knocking. I think it really cemented a sense that the traditional ways of doing politics in this country, or rather the entirely legal ways, are not enough. We need parties, I think, but we also need extra party devices. We need other things. We need social movements. Because if you just go through the parliamentary route, the British state will absolutely crush you. We had all manner of things going on to wreck Corbyn's campaign. And I think for a lot of people, this was a really radicalizing moment to say, actually, it's not enough that we live in a supposed parliamentary democracy. We need to actually fight for things we want on the streets, as workers, outside of party politics. And so it was this combined with the fact that I was watching on a day-to-day basis settlers harassing residents of Sheikh Jarrah. I was watching Israel bombard the Gaza Strip after these incidents with incendiary balloons in which I think around 200 people were killed and around 2,000 more were disabled by the Israeli forces. It was at this point that I thought that it was part of my duty as someone who lived in the kind of heart of empire, which continues to destroy what chances the global south has for a decent life for its people. I thought it was my duty to disrupt that destruction. And so I joined Palestine Action. Me and two others decided to occupy a site belonging to Hero DevTech, a French-Canadian aerospace company that produces landing gear for drones produced by Elbit Systems, the Hermes 450, which has been, again, incredibly instrumental in terrorizing people in Gaza long before 2023. We managed to occupy this site for a day, destroy lots of what was made inside the site, and then we were later arrested. Our court case was kicked down the road for about 2 years before two of us were sent to prison.
I don't think we have so much experience with this kind of direct action here. Could you maybe describe how you prepare? How do you assess the risks, for example? You know probably in advance that you will be arrested and there will be a court case.
You do know that they'll be arrested and that there'll be a court case, and you try as best as possible to plan for what that court case might look like and what sort of defenses you might run. In England, it's now pretty difficult to have a legal defense for any of this, even if you're not part of a prescribed organization. If you had a lawyer, you wouldn't necessarily be able to appeal to a jury directly at all, because there'd be no legal reason you can give. But if you decided to lose your lawyer and represent yourself, you would be able to make an argument which wasn't necessarily as legalistic, but was trying to appeal to the morality of the jury. I'll say from experience and the experience of comrades, it's very hard to know what court you'll end up in, what the jury will look like, what the judge will be like. These things are huge variables that will really disrupt your capacity to completely plan doing something like this. But there are ways in which you can prepare yourself as best as possible. I think it's important to inoculate yourself if you're part of any movement and really assess what the risks are. Like, really take into account, am I going to go to prison? Is this something that might happen? I don't say that to deter people. I think direct action is really important, but I say it to ensure that people don't completely feel destroyed by the experience and that they engage in the experience knowing that this might be a result from what they've done.
And then practically, how does this look to go to a factory and occupy it?
A lot of these factories are in the middle of nowhere. The reason for that is that a lot of them are built on Royal Ordnance factories. The Royal Ordnance factories were created during World War II. Because they made munitions, they had to be in really rural areas so that the Germans bombed them, it wouldn't kind of take out, you know, huge swathes of the city. So they're built on these sites, which means they're quite far away from everything. It's normally the one good gig in town. In these communities where the state has essentially abandoned them to neoliberalism. So it's really possible that you're going to a place where people are going to be really hostile to the idea that you're going to take over this factory and you're going to occupy it and destroy parts of it. You know, I'm a Marxist, so I don't believe that sort of production you're engaged in necessarily reflects who you are. And I think it's important to take this into account and really think about whether these are groups that you can engage in or not. With the case of Elbit Systems, we know that a lot of people who work there used to be part of the IDF. So Palestine Action have picked a strategic site because you're just not going to have this sort of engagement with workers there about what they're doing. Practically, you'll need a place to stay somewhere nearby. You'll need tents, sleeping bags, ladders. You'll probably need to do reconnaissance, and you'll probably need to know the people you're going to do these actions with really, really, really well, because it can be quite tense. And you need to be able to know that you can, like, throw a ladder up a wall. Like, I didn't know how to do that. I had to, you know, train for a little while to learn how to, like, get a ladder, throw it upwards really quickly, and then carry a really, really heavy backpack and just run up a factory wall. Most of the people I know who've engaged in things like this haven't necessarily encountered huge amounts of resistance from workers inside. This has begun slightly later, where some workers have got into actual fights with people doing this. But yeah, it's very rare.
So you go into the factory while it's in operation? Or did you go into the factory while it was in operation?
So a lot of these factories work for 24 hours at a time. So we went when it was still in operation. We run up and we go onto the roof. We give people notice. We tell them, this is what we're doing. Leave the factory. because it's a health and safety concern, they do leave the factory. It's not necessarily their choice. Their floor manager will normally say, okay, we can't operate. We don't know if they're going to do anything. To us, it's not safe. So they then leave. And then once we've made sure that people have left, we then were more confident in opening the factory up from the skylights using hammers and then throwing things inside. Other people have been more adventurous. They've maybe broken into skylights, climbed in, taken bits of equipment, or they've destroyed things at close range climbing into the factories. That's sort of up to the risk that people are willing to take on.
But the goal basically is to make the factory not operational as much as possible.
Yeah, so there's sort of numerous registers in which you're trying to operate. Obviously, it's a spectacle and it works as a form of propaganda in informing people about the ties the country has with a genocide and with Israel's colonization mission. It also operates on the material level because it's trying to take these factories out of operation for as long as possible. And sometimes you don't know what the net effect of this is. So this might be that you're engaged in a longer campaign, which is to put pressure on a company, not through one action, but through 10 or 20 or 30. We also know that there's a lot of bottlenecks around the production of arms. So if you ever read the Jewish Chronicle, you'll see that there's a guy, Yaakov Katz. He writes a little bit about F-35s. And at one point, he was really terrified that the Israeli hard right was going to stop the flow of F-35 parts from Britain and America because these aircrafts are really high maintenance and rely on a constant use of new parts. And so you don't necessarily know how much you're going to disrupt. If you go to a place that makes F-35 parts and those F-35 parts are due to leave to go to Israel, which in Britain is the case, often they go directly to Israel as parts, or they go to the US where they are then fitted into a whole plane, which is later transported elsewhere, you might be having a serious or meaningful impact at disrupting an ongoing genocide.
You're in the factory throwing stuff through the roof. How does this end?
In Britain, there's two special protest units. If you're lucky, both of them are already in operation somewhere else, so you can last for a while. For some comrades, they were on a roof for about 7 days. Part of the reason they're on this roof for 7 days is because there are really large sections of the Fire Brigades Union who are very pro-Palestine and hate the police. And normally, when all the other police forces are in operation, the police will say, okay, well, can you use your fire trucks to help take down the protesters? But loads of Fire Brigade members have just said, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to help the police at all. And this meant that people could stay out for a really long time, actually. In my case, I was less lucky. The Fire Brigade fully complied with the police. It depends from branch to branch. And we were there for a day, a night, and a day. It felt long enough to do some serious damage to the factory and put it out of operation for a long amount of time.
Then you're arrested. But that is, you started to say, not necessarily what happens. What are the other options?
I mean, you will always get arrested, but you have options whereby it might be that you're remanded, so you go straight to prison. In my case, I was out on bail for 2 years until my court case. We had a number of situations coming together in a way that made it very hard to successfully argue in court for our innocence, or at least give a sort of moral justification for the jury to use. But other people are able to do that. Then you go to prison. In our case, we were released after 4 months, or I was released after 4 months. Another comrade was kept for a lot longer due to previous charges he had and due to his involvement with the environmental movement. Currently, there's also a group called the Filton 23. They're a group who were all arrested. This was before the terror legislation relating to Palestine Action. The government claimed that there was a terrorism connection, which is as vague as it sounds, because the reality is too scary for the police and the state, which is that they have no consent to govern, and that the majority of people simply despise Israel and want to see a free Palestine and despise having to watch a live stream genocide every day. So these individuals have all been on remand. They haven't been charged yet, and they've been kept in prison for over a year. If I can be cheeky and suggest to anyone listening, look up the campaign of the Filton 23. People in prison really, really value outsider support. If it's letters, if it's money, if it's anything, this goes really a long way in sustaining people in prison. If you're not able to engage in the sort of direct action that is trying to rupture Israeli colonization, then second best thing is supporting people that do that.
And now this organization of which you were part been what, 2 months or something like that since this action on the airbase, after which they were proscribed as a terrorist organization. Can you tell me what this means and what are the consequences?
Essentially, as you may have seen, 2 or 3 individuals entered into a military site on electric scooters and defaced a plane that was allegedly going to be used by the British Army to help with reconnaissance for the Israelis. They vandalized this plane, and this led Yvette Cooper and Keir Starmer to proscribe Palestine Action as an organization. I do not know the ins and outs of the law entirely, but what this effectively means is that anyone who is believed to be a member or even show support for the organization can be charged under terror laws, in which you can be sentenced to 14 years in prison. It makes your capacity to access work, access any sort of public finance, incredibly difficult. It means you essentially live your life under public surveillance after, of course, serving a very lengthy prison sentence. And so the group Defend Our Juries, so they've gone out en masse with these T-shirts that say Defend Our Juries and say we support our Palestine Action to test this law, because if the British government really believes that anyone who supports Palestine Action is a terrorist, then they have to abide by their own law, and they should now set about charging these 70, 80-year-old individuals under this terror legislation.
How does it look to you? Do they plan on doing it? From what I've seen, at least, the police seem to be under the impression that they have to arrest everybody.
The police will arrest everybody, but whether they'll charge them is a different story. And there were significant numbers of people who weren't arrested at the last protest they have. I think, really, this is like overreach from the state, and this is going to cause a huge amount of internal rupture that isn't necessarily visible to us right now. I can't imagine that the police are going to be super happy about having to process hundreds and hundreds of 80-year-olds for wearing a T-shirt. I can't imagine that the already overwhelmed prison system is going to be capable of absorbing these individuals. The British state, you know, is seen as this like incredibly bureaucratic machine, but it's not efficient. It's falling apart at the seams the whole time. It's not very well funded. So none of it works. I don't think the British government can really meaningfully carry it out. I really think this is an opportunity that people should take up to really push the British state, because I think it's a massive overreach.
Isn't there also a possibility that they decide to be hypocritical about it and not charge the 80-year-olds, but charge whoever else they want, so that the system becomes completely arbitrary and you can't know, are you going to prison for 14 years or are you just getting off with a slap on the wrist or something?
I think that's a real possibility, and we've seen that the way in which terror legislation applies, it's never on equal footing. If the law was to be applied rigorously in the UK, then the many, many different people that have gone to fight for the Israeli forces from Britain would all be prosecuted right now. They'd all be facing charges for fighting for a foreign army. But of course, that's not the case. That's reserved for people that go and fight with Kurdish forces, for instance, in Rojava, for liberation, essentially, and not for people that are engaging in a genocide and ongoing colonialism. So you're absolutely right to point to that very real possibility. And I guess if that emerged, that would be something that people in Britain would need to think seriously about, how you overcome the impasse there.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
Poslušali ste intervju s britanskim aktivistom Charliem Thomasom. Z njim sem se na festivalu Grounded pogovarjal Vid.